Casey Mulligan Walsh is our next guest and has a brand new memoir out called The Full Catastrophe, All I Ever Wanted, Everything I Feared. Orphaned at 12 and soon the only surviving sibling, Casey marries young, has three children, but her marriage isn't the dream she envisioned. Ultimately, a divorce and custody trial propel her family into a catastrophe of a different sort, and each of her children suffers. Struggling alongside them, she draws strength from spirituality. Then the unthinkable happens. Her firstborn, Eric, dies at the age of just 20, and she's left to make sense of her family's collapse and the loss of her beloved son. In a moving testament to the power of love, The Full Catastrophe tells of a life of loss and sorrow, and one that's transformed into hope and redemption. The name of the book is The Full Catastrophe, All I Ever Wanted, Everything I Feared. It is just out, and Casey Mulligan joins us this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe. I'm just delighted to be here.
It's really nice to have you here. Now, much of this book takes place in the town that I live very near, is Cambridge, New York. And you were a resident there when most of this book takes place.
Yes.
What brought you to Cambridge initially?
Well, that I would have to go back to my childhood when I lived in Bergen County, New Jersey, the suburbs of New York. And my parents died 11 months apart. And so once my mother died, I was sent to Hoosick Falls, New York, to live with relatives. And Cambridge is only a town north of Hoosick Falls. So I met my husband up at the lakes where lots of us went.
Oh, what lake?
Let's see. I met him at Lake Lauderdale, but I spent a lot of time at Hedges Lake.
Hedges Lake at the Pavilion.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes. And then the cottage that our family had was on Hedges Lake. So my kids kind of grew up at Hedges Lake.
Very nice.
Yeah. So I met him. We married when I was 20. I moved to Cambridge, which was actually... I often think of Cambridge as kind of another character in the story.
Sure.
It was the perfect setting for what I was looking for, and safety and security in an idyllic small town. I worked in the only bank in town for 20 years, so at one point I think I knew everybody in every house. Went to a local church. My kids were very involved, so it really was a wraparound for me of all the things I was looking for.
And when you, just starting with being orphaned at such a young age, going to live with relatives, I mean, that is in itself a traumatic start, really, to life. As loving as the situation may have been, it's still a lot, especially for a young person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. My father's family was from Washington County, Rensselaer County, Eagle Bridge, Buskirk.
Yep.
And so it was my father's sister who I went to live with, who was a teacher in Hoosick Falls. He had another sister who lived on a farm out in Buskirk. And my brother was 7 years older than me, so I was sent to live upstate. He stayed in New Jersey. So I was kind of, I always picture that claw in the stuffed animal machine that just kind of picks up an animal and plunks it down. I was basically delivered to Hoosick Falls with my dresser and my mother's sewing machine, and that was it. So I was really away from anything that I knew. And I lived there. I was in seventh grade, which is any of us who have been seventh graders knows that's about the worst time to have a big shift like that. And I lived in Hoosick Falls until basically I went to college.
I just want to back up. You write in the book, I miss my dad, but since he died, I felt all twisted up with a mix of secret gratitude that it wasn't my mother who had left me so suddenly and guilt for feeling that way. I couldn't imagine life without her. Now she's dying too.
Yes, yes. So my mother had breast cancer, and she had breast cancer for a very long time. So, and of course, I knew she was sick. I knew she had cancer. It was a different time, and maybe some people would still make this choice, but nobody really told me she would die. You know, she never got better, but I didn't expect her to die. My father, on the other hand, had heart disease. And of course, it was the mid-1960s. They didn't know a lot about that. And so she was kind of the terminally ill person who they all expected to die. And then my father died of a heart attack 11 months before my mother died. So he died first. I'll just interject. My brother died at 27, and he died of a massive heart attack. And it turns out that we have familial hypercholesterolemia in our family, which is a genetic lipid disorder. I was diagnosed the year after my brother died. So I have it. Two of my children were diagnosed with it, and my granddaughter has it, which is why one of the launch celebrations is also a fundraiser for the Family Heart Foundation.
We'll talk about that in a minute. I will note that on your website, which I'll give that out, but there's a lot of information about people finding resources and information.
Yes, thank you.
In regards to that. So then, so you're there, you go to college, and as you say, you know, first comes love and then comes marriage. Mm-hmm. And so that time is where things start to change, and I assume you're feel like you're on a different path.
I do. As I say a lot when I talk about the book, I was on this search for home that really rose above every other goal I had. I was a strong student. I could have, done all kinds of things. But as I feel like at that point in my life, I needed a home more than I needed an education, or at least that's what I felt. And so settling in that small town definitely, made me feel as if I was on the right path. However, things did not go as idyllically as I had hoped.
How old were the children when you were divorced?
Well, the divorce was long and protracted. When it started, it was about 3.5 year process. When the divorce began, oh gosh, I think maybe they were about, I have to count backwards, like 9, 14, and 17, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, but young.
Mm-hmm. Young, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, very young.
Yeah.
All born at Mary McClellan?
All born in Bennington at Southwestern
Bennington,
Vermont.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, you went across the border,
did you? I went across the border for that. But as you see in the book, we did a few other things at Mary McClellan.
Yes, absolutely. So when did you start to feel that there were problems in the marriage?
Well, the thing is, it was a mismatch from the beginning. And so the marriage really was never great. It got worse. But as I write, I think my one defining quality is being determined, and determination can be a really good quality. It can also not be a great quality because it can make you kind of refuse to see when enough is enough and change your direction. So I think the more difficult it got, the more determined I became. And that's what happened.
When, as you said, it was protracted. And there was a custody trial you write about it, but what's the crux of it? What's the dispute?
Well, my two older boys, one of them, while this process was going on, became over 18. So he wasn't even in question. My son, Eric, who died, and my middle son was about 16 when we were going to family court, and the judge wisely said, I just don't think I can tell a 16-year-old where he has to be. So it was really around my daughter, who was younger. And she kind of became her father's goal and prize, and if she was with him, she could do whatever she wanted. And so we kind of had this dynamic where I had been the parent who was very involved in school, and she had an IEP, and I was involved in all of that. He didn't think that was all very important. So it became kind of this quest for me for what I felt like was to save her. But eventually it became clear it wasn't helping, and he wasn't going to give up his position, and I needed to decide what was going to give us all the most peace. And that's when I decided that we would just have shared custody.
Which is, and that was, because you get into the fight, right? I mean, there's the fight, and then there's the, oh, this is what I'm doing to the family at large.
Yes, yes. And, I've said a lot of times that any situation is only as sane as the least sane person in it. So it's very difficult when you've got someone on the other side who doesn't really, there's nothing they won't do. They're not as worried about what's going to be damaging, that you can't. I think what this goes to is the fact that what I realized that we would all do well to realize younger than I did is that control is kind of an illusion. You know, we work really hard to try to control things. And, you know, I'm really loving Pema Chodron and the whole idea that, you know, all life is uncertainty.
Yep.
And the more you embrace it and figure out what it has for you, I think part of that spiritual transformation for me was getting to that place, moving from that place of dug in determination to understanding that I just needed to accept what was happening.
You mentioned a local church, but what was the entry into a broader spirituality?
Well, you know, this kind of runs throughout the book as well. From the time I was very young, we moved a lot when I was a child.
Yeah.
And I was just always determined to get to church. My family didn't go, but I always hooked up with a family who would take me. And, you know, part of it was I did have this innate sense of spirituality. But part of it, I think, too, was we didn't have extended family. They felt like extended family to me. But I was involved in Coila Church for a long, long time,
yep.
Probably 25 years. And this was not a change from that, but in addition to that, something that that kind of spirituality that made it more functional for me. And kind of a lot of East meets West concepts that, you know, we're all connected, we're not separate, that we can't be separated even by death, that basically that everything that isn't love is fear, and we're always operating either out of love or whether it's anger or jealousy or any of those negative emotions, it really all stems from a place of fear within ourselves.
So you were really having that, using the spirituality and as a coping mechanism while going through this and even in the aftermath.
Absolutely. And you know, I still do sometimes, but I have like a really difficult time describing this. But one of the things I'll say is that I came to a place that I think that people who have children with addiction issues, which was not Eric's issue, or terminally ill children often have to come to, which is in the thick of all of this we were going through, realizing that I had to come to a place where I could imagine living in a world without one of my children. And that's a really tough place to get to as a parent.
So, by the way, we're talking to Casey Mulligan Walsh. The new book is The Full Catastrophe. And Casey is going to be talking about the book tonight. There's a book launch event, a party for the Family Heart Foundation. It's a fundraiser at Glenn Peter Jewelers in Albany. And then on Saturday, you'll be back home in Cambridge at the Battenkill Bookstore in Cambridge, New York, in conversation with Jessica Fine. And that'll be at 2 o'clock. And you can find out information about both events by going to CaseyMulliganWalsh.com, as well as finding out information about the book. When you were talking about the custody, of course, the judge is looking at this and saying that your son is the oldest and he is free to make his own decisions over 18. Obviously, as a mom, you see that much differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you lose him.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, talk about how that happened.
Well, Eric died on what we used to know as Cambridge Day, a big festival in Cambridge. And this was back just before the balloon festival started. So there was a foot race that would start at the school. And I always had a group of people at my house. So we had a little party that day. And he and his brother were driving around all day. And he died on Route 22 in a single car crash. It was June 12th, 1999.
And that's the worst thing that can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
How does it change the dynamic between you and your ex-husband?
Well, my ex-husband died in 2008.
Okay.
In kind of a freak, you may remember there was a snowstorm a week before Christmas that year where we didn't have power for days and days. And he was kind of the local guy who helped everyone out. He was very generous in that way. He was probably plowing people's driveways for 36 hours straight. And he had been a mechanic. He owned garages, so he was wise about things like this. But there was some sort of a freak carbon monoxide thing that happened at his house, and they believe that he had a space heater on, and when the power surged on, yes, and so he died quite a long time ago. People ask me a lot about, you know, dealing with sensitivity about the other characters in the book, but a large majority of the characters in the book have died. Not everyone, but that changes what you're able to write. And
meaning it gives you a bit more freedom.
It gives you a bit more freedom, but I also think it gives you a bit more responsibility to also see, you know, where you went wrong and what their behavior that was felt was so hurtful to you may have stemmed from. And so I think it was really important not to write revenge memoir, and I worked really hard to do that.
No, but the opposite could be true, too, where you feel like you're a survivor.
Yes. Yes, both of those things are true. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then how do you at that? I mean, that's the full catastrophe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was in the sun.
Yeah, the full catastrophe, you know, has that double meaning, which
sure.
is why I like it so well. And so in Zorba the Greek, you know, boss says, are you married? And he says, am I not a man? Of course I'm married. I've got it all, the wife, the car, the kids, the full catastrophe. And for me, you know, John Kabat-Zinn's book, Full Catastrophe Living, talks about the full catastrophe as the poignant enormity of our life experiences. And so the full catastrophe is what I wanted, right? Bring the bills and the dirty diapers and the lessons and all those things that come with having a busy family. But then, you know, as you read in the book, I had the literal full catastrophe.
And there is a transformation. I mean, as your wife starts to transform and things start to move in a more positive direction for you, right?
Yes.
I mean, a more livable, positive direction.
Yes.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I do attribute it to that spiritual seeking that I did that was really just a lifeline during the divorce. I mean, I really did come to the point. There is kind of a dark night of the soul and a place where I feel as if maybe I'll never have any of this family I built. Maybe my kids were all angry and you know, just off in different directions. And so there was a time I thought, you know, how long am I going to beat my head into this cement wall before I turn around and go the other way and find a different way? And it's you know, that famous Viktor Frankl quote, when we're unable to change our circumstances, we're challenged to change ourselves. And I could see that just driving forward with this determination was not going to save me. And I needed to find a different way to see the world and a way to find that belonging and love and mothering and all those things within myself and from a higher power. One of the things that drove me to write this book the most is that the day that Eric died, there's a lot, I don't want to get into all of the details, but he was really kind of falling apart between his graduation from high school and when he died at age 20. And he had a lot of factors that impacted that, the divorce, not the least of them. Mm-hmm. And, when he died, that I have a good friend who kind of been with me through all of this and actually was there the day that he died. And it was just mind-blowing, the sorts of things that the two of us had been talking about for a couple of years, how meaningful they were that day. It was almost as though, you know, all of that had been to prepare me for that day. And so it wasn't only that I kind of continued having these spiritual tenets that really comforted me, but they are completely what helped me navigate my grief and understand that that even in the most heartbreaking moments, there's room for unexpected joy and peace, and that what life is about embracing the messiness and the uncertainty. And if I hadn't had, I think, those two difficult years leading up to the day Eric died, I would never have been able to get through that the way that I did.
So in that description, it seems in some way you were almost, whether you obviously didn't know it at the time, but were prepared for it more than most people would be.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've had people like balk when I use that word prepared. Of course, you're never prepared for the death of a child. But it definitely, what I say is that that spirituality that just was my lifeline during the divorce is what helped me navigate that grief and find a deeper sense of belonging. When Eric died that whole day, and I tried very hard to render it this way, I just had this kind of internal conversation that was set juxtaposed with what I was saying, so that when the police came to the door, the first thing I thought was, you knew this day was cut. Like, this is the end of the story. There were things happening for Eric that were not going to end well. I didn't know how they weren't going to end well. And so there was a sense of, not that I ever thought he would die, but when he did die, there was this sense of inevitability that's almost hard to explain. And I just thought, this is the day you knew was coming. Your job is to walk through it gracefully. It didn't feel chaotic. It felt like, not in a good way, but that all these spinning pieces were kind of falling into place. And that does not mean I didn't have deep grief and sorrow, but peace does not preclude sorrow. You can have peace and be deeply grieving and sad at the same time.
He died in what year?
1999.
Yeah. You left the village what year?
Well, I had gone back to school in 1996 to St. Rose to become a speech-language pathologist. So by that time, I was working at Tamarack, the Britton Kill School District. And so I was spending a lot of my time outside of Cambridge anyway. But in 2001, I met my husband. And so, you know, then I had my home there, but I was back and forth a lot. I finally actually moved from there in, I would say, August of 2002.
I asked the question because I think of this often when tragedy strikes in a village. It's felt far and wide, and I mean it's to me it's a blessing and it's a curse, right?
Absolutely.
I mean it is a family, and the people come together, mm-hmm. and they're lovely and they're beautiful and they help you, mm-hmm. and they smother you with love and affection.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, you want them gone.
Yeah, I totally hear you. I often wonder if it was a different experience for me because I had created this family that fell apart. My husband's parents lived across the street. They were my parents. They were my family. And so when the divorce happened, I lost them too.
Yeah.
And so there were probably 100 people in my house that weekend and phone call after phone call. I needed that. I wanted that. I welcomed that. I don't know how I would have gotten through it without that. I didn't feel so much that I wanted them gone as that they are gone. And so, I've had enough death in my life, besides my parents and my brother, many other people. And so those of us who have come to this age anyway are well aware that all of this stuff happens and there are the services and then it's quiet. And then the real grieving begins.
Right.
And you have to, this is the first day of carrying this with you for the rest of your life. That part was difficult for me. So when the people were there, actually, it was very welcome for me.
The name of the new book is The Full Catastrophe, All I Ever Wanted, Everything I Feared, a memoir. It is just out. By Casey Mulligan Walsh. There will be a book launch party for the Family Heart Foundation at Glenn Peter Jewelers in Albany tonight, 5:30 to 7:30. And then a big book launch on Saturday, February 22nd, in Cambridge, New York, at Batten Kill Books. You can find out more information about all of the events by going to CaseyMulliganWalsh.com. Casey, it's a
great treat to get to speak to you. Thank you very much for being with us and for sharing this morning. I appreciate it.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Be well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.